Welcome everybody to Respect Graduate School. We're happy to have our inaugural academic conference, Islam in America, Civic and Religious Youth Identities. We're very thankful that you joined us. You'll be seeing more of me. My name is Zahra Khan. But for now, I'm going to turn the microphone over to our president, Dr. Suleiman Eris. Please help me welcome him.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Good morning. We are very glad to have you here today. You are a blessing and you are very special people for us. Thank you. Esteemed guests, students, faculty, scholars, spiritual leaders from various community faiths and community members, I greet you with greetings of peace and ask God to bless each of you. May God bless our gathering with His godly acceptance. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you all for joining us on this momentous occasion. Respect Graduate School is very excited to present its inaugural academic conference, Islam in America, Civic and Religious Youth Identities. We are exceedingly grateful to Mr. Sayed al-Marzuqi from Reading, Pennsylvania, for his generous sponsorship for the conference. Definitely without his support, none of this would have been possible. And I would also like to take this opportunity to thank Dr. Zahra Khan, who just introduced me, the conference coordinator, a friend and colleague of Respect Graduate School, who committed herself wholeheartedly to the success of this conference. Respect Graduate School has made its home here in Lehigh Valley. We offer a Master of Arts degree in Islamic Studies. Some of you may not be aware of this, but there are very few institutions of higher learning in the United States that offer Islamic studies. And that makes our task even all more important and pressing. Respect's vision is to serve the Lehigh Valley and our nation as a whole by educating women and men for scholarship, especially in Islamic studies. We want our graduates to go forward and provide leadership in Muslim communities and in social roles, developing knowledge and putting into practice with excellence, locally as well as globally. Our mission is to be an institution where students and faculty engage in research, teaching, learning, service, with an emphasis on Islamic studies for the public good. Respect builds meaningful bridges with other local faith-based educational and artistic communities, providing students with networking skills and opportunities for mutually beneficial connections. Given our mission and vision, our pedagogical praxis here at Respect Graduate School focuses on the academic pursuit of excellence, academic integrity, and respect for the intellectual endeavors of others, cultural and social diversity, and the ability to contribute to such. It is in this way that we have imagined and organized the Islam in America Conference. The theme of our inaugural conference is Islam in America, Civic and Religious Youth Identities. With this theme, we hope to look forward into the terrain of upcoming generation of American Muslims and be able to offer some analysis of the major theoretical questions and historical problems that Islam in America will most likely encounter. History matters, of course, and so you will find that several of the papers look back to the lessons in history before beginning to articulate prescriptions for the future. ideas also matter. And several other papers deal with the philosophical implications of our time in light of Islamic principles and norms. Our status report as a community matters too. And several papers you hear today and tomorrow will give an account of where American Muslims find ourselves in our religious identities as well as our civic fulfillments. We were surprised by the high quality of papers we received when we put our call for papers last spring. And we are thankful to God for having brought us all together to think through these issues. As we hope you will listen carefully and critically, today and tomorrow, you will find a robust selection of papers spanning several timely and important areas. The presenters have all worked very hard in their respective fields, and it is our honor as an institution of higher education to receive their work. The presenters represent diverse backgrounds, specializations, and methodologies. They have traveled from near and far to be here today. Some have come from across the country, across international boundary, and even across the ocean. Respect Graduate School thanks you and ask God to increase you in knowledge and increase your reward, inshallah. With that, it is truly my honor and pleasure to introduce you our keynote speaker for Islam in America, Civic and Religious Youth Identities, Dr. Ingrid Madsen. Dr. Madsen is the London and Winster Community Chair in Islamic Studies at Huron University College at the University of Western Ontario, Canada. She was educated in Canada and the United States, earning a PhD from the University of Chicago in 1999. From 1998 to 2012, she was Professor of Islamic Studies at Hartford Seminary in Connecticut, where she developed and directed the first accredited graduate program for Muslim chaplains in America. It was at Hartford also that she served as director of the McDonald Center for the Study of Islam and Christian-Muslim Relationships. From 2001 to 2010, Dr. Madsen served as vice president, then as president of the Islamic Society of North America, the first woman to serve in either position. Her writings, both academic and public, focus primarily on the Quran and its interpretation, Islamic theological ethics, and interfaith relations. Her book, The Story of the Quran, Its History and Place in Muslim Life, which was recently reprinted in a second edition, is an academic bestseller and was chosen by the U.S. National Endowment for the Humanities for Inclusion in its Bridging Cultures program. There are, of course, many more contributions I could enumerate that decorate Dr. Madsen's long list of accomplishments. But instead, I prefer to mention why we are honored that Dr. Madsen accepted our invitation to deliver our inaugural academic conference keynote address. Dr. Madsen is a Western academic and, at the same time, a committed Muslim thinker. As such, she enjoys the unique positionality and responsibility of performing a sort of dual translation between worlds and histories of meaning. For the Muslim community, she is a teacher of liberal academic practices, processes, and achievements. For Western academia, she's a religious, practicing Muslim woman, obligated by her own admission to our beautiful faith. And this is no small challenge. As our own faculty here at Respect Graduate School will tell you, to be a committed Muslim and a Western academic presents a unique set of puzzles and tests. Dr. Mattson is a shining example of how to navigate these puzzles. Let me give you one example from her work, The Story of the Quran. In this work, Dr. Mattson provides a general academic audience with clarity and accessibility, reasoned and research insights about the Quran's significance to Muslim life, about popular and high culture institutions from Islamic history and holistic frameworks for assessing legal rulings. She highlights the relationship between religious knowledge, good character, and the community's trust, between textual worth and practice among the living community. Dr. Mattson reiterates the Muslim maxim of the importance of approaching the Quran with presence of heart. To quote from her, she says, "It is not just knowledge but exemplary behavior that in the minds of the faithful gives any individual the authority to speak on behalf of the divine. This is particularly true in Islam, which despite its development of sophisticated institutions of religious education and formation, never embraced a system of ordination. We have seen that the rigid and destructive literalism of the Khawarij in the first century of Islam demonstrated an important lesson to the Muslim community, which is that a person could master the text of the Quran while at the same time acting in complete opposition to its spirit. Knowledge without good character does not confer much authority." End quote. Engaging dual communities of meaning, and I don't mean to suggest that these are mutually exclusive communities, they are not. Speaking to general Muslim and Western academic audiences, Dr. Mattson states that while Muslims should have full confidence in the power of God to guide us to correct understandings, nonetheless, our declarations about true meanings in the Quran should at times be tempered. When faced with imperatives to make judgments and take action, as undeniably Muslims, American Muslims are today, we must remember that God knows the best and the better. At the same time that she offers much needed enjoinders to Muslims, some of her claims must come as surprising or unwelcome interjections to her Western academic colleagues. For example, Dr. Mattson's reiteration of the normative Muslim claims that epistemological certainty is a fruit of spiritual struggle, or that meaning exists only in the relation to ultimate meaning, which resides only with God. These positions may be an affront to secular foundations of a liberal academic knowledge system or epistemology, but they represent a faithful articulation, an extension of the Muslim testimony of faith that there is no God but God and Muhammad is the messenger, peace be upon him. For this reason, we are honored to bring you Dr. Ingrid Mattson, because on her approach is a great lesson and example for American Muslims. In closing, we are delighted and humbled that you have joined us for this landmark in our institution's growth. With Islam in America's civic and religious youth identities, we hope to set into motion scholarly discussions across institutions, methodologies, academic disciplines, ethnic communities, and faith groups. Best wishes to you all, and please join me in welcoming to our keynote speaker, Dr. Ingrid Mattson.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Assalamu alaikum. Peace. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى آله وصحبه أجمعين. A little bit of feedback. We might need to turn this down a little bit. Well, I begin my talk in the name of God, the merciful, the compassionate. I am so grateful to be here today to come to Respect Graduate School. I came here yesterday for the first time, and as I said last night, I'm just so incredibly impressed. We know that the Prophet Muhammad, may God's peace and blessings be upon him, said, "Inna Allah kataba al-ihsan 'ala kulli shay." God has ordained excellence in everything. Ihsan. Ihsan is doing something in the best way possible. And just walking into this building and walking into the musalla, seeing the beauty in every aspect of this school, I'm so impressed. All I can think of is, this is ihsan, mashallah. And even the introduction, I've never had such a detailed, well-researched introduction. I mean, usually people kind of pull a biography off the internet and it's outdated, like I've taught there for 5 years or something. And mashallah, Brother Suleiman, everything's done so well, so thank you so much for that, and I'll reward you. I want to also recognize, before we begin, my good friend Rubina Tareen, who really is the reason I'm here. You know, full disclosure, mostly I'm here because I wanted to see her. Whenever she has an invitation, I'm like, oh, great, I could be with Rubina again. But alhamdulillah, that also meant that I could come here and learn about Respect and the mission and vision, and I'm very impressed. So this morning, what I want to do is I read about the theme of the conference. I looked at the papers that are being presented, and I really want to focus on this. I feel like I'm getting a lot of feedback in this mic. All right, so we'll try to adjust that. I'm very distractible. So if I hear feedback, I can't talk because there's feedback. So I was very moved by the focus on young people and their development. And I particularly picked up a line from the call to papers in the description of this conference about the need for tools for healthy self-development and constructive social civic contributions. I'm very interested in our community and the psycho-spiritual health of our community. It's why I was so interested in chaplaincy, and one of the reasons why it was important to me in developing the chaplaincy program and having this be a mainstream model of religious leadership and service to our community. I don't know how you feel, but I feel that our community overall is in a state of great anxiety and tension. You know, raise your hand if you feel that we seem to be particularly stressed at this time. It's not like it's the worst period in human history. We know that throughout history, there always are challenges, political, military, you know, all sorts of different things that happen. But I feel that there are so many negative impacts and stresses on us at this time. I mean, in American society generally, really, you know, it's not just Muslims. I mean, American society is really facing a lot of stresses from so many forces. And then for the Muslim community, with all of the, of course, Islamophobia, racism, all of the major conflicts going on in the world, where we are really suffering from seeing the suffering of others and being so limited in what we can do. So when we look at our children and our young people, we see the impacts, and we know that there have been many studies on the mental health of young people today and how stressed they feel, how much anxiety is just, you know, anxiety levels are off the roof. And just, it is really something that we have to take seriously. And so today, what I want to do is I want to point to a few areas where we need to do more work to help support our community. And that work needs to be supported by research. It means we need study. It means we need research. It means we need to develop methods and ways and habits and customs and culture that will help build a more spiritually and mentally resilient community. And so, you know, one of my great goals in life is to make myself redundant. My dream is always just to finally be able to go away and live back in the woods in where I live in Canada, and the land of my ancestors. There's a place where I go for at least a few weeks a year, sometimes more than that. I want to go back there, so I'm just giving you all this work to do. I'm giving you the ideas. I want you to take these ideas on. When I created a midwife training program when I worked with Afghan refugees, when the Soviet Union still existed and the Soviets were occupying Afghanistan, I wasn't a midwife, but I saw the need for that, and I felt that skill base and knowledge base would really serve the people in that particular context. And so I created a midwife training program, and I'm not a chaplain, but I felt that chaplains were the people who could really help elevate the level of spiritual and religious leadership in our community and also provide the services that are so needed. It's why I teach, you know, the students. We just hope the students are just going to take over the academic positions. So that's what I'm here to do today, is really just throw out some ideas and hope that others will pick them up and institutionalize them and research them. And I'm going to begin with something that is really, you know, what I'm talking about are issues of the deepest importance to human beings, our spiritual life, our mental health, our relationships. And to do that, I'm going to perhaps make you feel a little uncomfortable at the beginning, but these are serious issues. And one of the problems about an academic environment is the constant necessity, this convention of constantly taking yourself out of the issue, right? Acting as if these are subjects to be studied, and we are the objective observers, the neutral observers, and that leads to all sorts of problems. I mean, where we don't acknowledge our own subjectivities, but it also means that we create, when we're talking about an institution that's a seminary or theology or, you know, pastoral care, we're talking about human beings, and we're in that. And so it's important that we become, I refuse to take myself out of the equation. I refuse to pretend that it has nothing to do with me, because it has everything to do with me. And unless we acknowledge that we are not just scholars, that we're human beings who are embedded in these systems of knowledge and power, then we're never going to be able to find truly the solutions. So, to begin with, thinking about tools for healthy self-development, I'll tell you about an experience I had this summer. My mother, my 85-year-old mother, who was really a pillar of my life, one of the reasons why I moved back to Canada. We'd gone to our cottage and we'd spent a week cleaning, cutting branches. I mean, we have a really back to nature kind of place. No indoor plumbing. I mean, this is, so we went to the island, we did all of this work. My mother's extremely vigorous, healthy, hard worker, you know, I was exhausted just keeping up with her. And came home 2 days later, just going for a walk with her friend, had a little weakness in her leg, and thought to herself, oh boy, maybe I'm having a little stroke or something. Walked into the emergency room, they scanned her and they found that she had cancer metastasized throughout her whole body, from her brain to her adrenal glands and everywhere in between. They told her there's nothing we can do. She said, well, I want to die at home. So she went home. I moved in with her. My brothers and sisters also gathered around. I come from a big family. Most of us moved into the house. And thank God, Canada has universal health care. I mean, we didn't have to think about that. Beautiful palliative care program. Doctor came to the house. A nurse came to the house every day. Personal support workers were sent to cover, to come to the house every day for most of the time to support us. I mean, all of this is just, I mean, you don't even think about it. It's there, that support for you. And she died in 7 weeks. She went from full vitality to 7 weeks, where she passed away. Now, my mother was a Roman Catholic, and we used to have a lot of fun with that. I used to take my mom on trips with me once a year. I'd pick a place that she would like to travel to. And a few years ago, I took her to the Catholic Muslim Forum in Rome, and she met Pope Francis. Just the thrill of her life. Beautiful, you know, she got, the Vatican takes beautiful pictures, framed it, put it up in the kitchen, the first thing that anyone would see when they walk in the house. It's just beautiful. And what I loved about that experience and traveling with her, because normally what we would do, I would be invited to Bible Muslim communities in Europe or interfaith, you know, things, and there'd be on one side of the table the Christians and the other side the Muslims. And we would always come in together as a team, you know. That crossing that boundary, we were mother and daughter, a Catholic and a Muslim, loving each other, being together, and you know, where do we sit, which side of the table? And that's very much the life that we have as Muslims in America. I mean, many of us have interfaith families, and if not interfaith families, we have certainly very good friends and neighbors and close colleagues who are from other faith traditions. And that relationship is meaningful to us. I always think about faith communities like families. We have our, you know, nuclear family of faith and then our extended family of faith. And certainly when you're with your nuclear family, you have more obligations, you spend more time, but you also have a relationship with your extended family, your cousins and your aunts and uncles and others. And so how do we make those connections more meaningful, not just dialogue, not just working together, but really sanctifying them? You know, what do those relationships mean in an ultimate sense? Why did God put us here together in an ultimate sense? And to make those meaningful. So as my mother, you know, became weaker and the last day, when we felt she was near the end, and we brought the priest had come by and had given her last rites, and we had said everything we could say, and she was at the stage of not being able to communicate anymore, although it was still responsive. And in that final period, I felt this rush of, you know, we wanted to communicate to her, but in a way that would allow her to pass out of this life. You know, when we said the Christian prayers, and I read Quran, and I, you know, put my hand on her, and I read from, I read Ayatul Kursi, and I read from Surat An-Nur, about God being the light of the heavens and the earth. But I felt it was still, you know, it was that state where she still needed something. She needed something to carry her out. And I felt like there had to be something more. And at that time, I remember from my childhood this beautiful song that the nuns who taught me used to sing. A beautiful little, it's kind of a round. Peace is flowing like a river. Anyone know that song?
Yes.
Peace is flowing like a river, flowing out of you and me, flowing out into the desert, setting all captives free. Peace and love and joy. So I sang this song to her, it flowed out of me. And within minutes, she gave her last breath. And my brothers and sisters, they said that's what she needed. She needed to be sung out of this life. And how many other times I have felt the need for that expression, for a sanctified expression. Not just prayers, we have our prayers. Right? Giving back to God what God gave us, Quran recitation, prayers that the Prophet gave us, but our own expression of our human state, not just as an individual expression, but as a connection. And so every time I've lost someone, I found myself singing, and I'm not a good singer, right? That's not the point. It's not about performance, it's about expression. And it's occurred to me that we are really impoverished as an American Muslim community, and that we don't have a common songbook. Is there an American Muslim songbook? I don't have it. Now, in most Muslim-majority cultures, there are songs, there are rituals, there are rites of passage that have grown out of that land, out of that language, out of those experiences, out of those traditions. When we come here to the melting pot that is America, we may still continue some of those in our family or with those who also share that culture or that language. But when we come together in our mixture, a lot of that falls away because we don't want to impose one language on the people who don't speak that or our culture on them. And so these things kind of start to fall away. And at the same time, we have, that's a kind of natural reason, you could say, or social reason, contextual reason. Of course, there's also ideology that has tried to erase all of those things. And we know that American Islam, for so long, has had the negative effects of Wahhabi ideology. And just call it what it is. You know, we've had a few decades where Wahhabi publishing houses have sent boxes of free literature to mosques and Islamic centers and schools across America, making everything haram, like everything's prohibited. Music is prohibited, celebrations prohibited, everything is. So it's a kind of cultural genocide, Islamic cultural genocide of these things. So when I first became Muslim, I heard, people would tell me, oh no, music's haram, this is haram. Whoa, what, like, what kind of sad, sad religion are you talking about? That's not the Islam I experienced when I first met Senegalese Muslims in France. They didn't think music was prohibited. And joy and celebration and community. So I think that our community has gotten to the point where we realize that is a school of thought, a marginal school of thought, not representative of the majority of Islamic tradition. And we've had scholars who have talked about the importance of building culture. Scholars like Dr. Sherman Jackson, scholars like Dr. Ahmed Farouk Abdallah. You know, if you've never read his articles, Islam and the Cultural Imperative, or Innovation and Creativity in Islam, I highly recommend them. Read them to understand the support and the evidence of the need for culture and how that has emerged over time in Islamic societies. So we have that, but unfortunately, I would say that in many cases, what I've seen, the response to Dr. Ahmed's teachings and others has been primarily the emergence of what is necessary but not sufficient professional artists. So professional singers, comedians, actors, performance, right? Which is great, and we need to have masters of these arts. But it's not sufficient because the rest of the community, we remain spectators. We remain spectators, not very often participants. So we need to have forms of expression and community and rituals that bind us together and that convey and promote our feelings, our expression, our hopes, our dreams together. Not to erase our individuality, but to add on to that. And we live in America. We have to remember how powerful the commodification of culture is as a force in America. Herbert Marcuse, who was a Marxist art critic, wrote about how capitalism appropriates all forms of resistance. So if you think about, for example, what's that Netflix show, The Get Down? Anyone watch it? Okay. So the 70s, the era of where graffiti and tagging emerged as an art form in New York. Right? So, but first, it emerged as a form of resistance, as a form of expression, as a form of challenging the invisibility of the people who live in those neighborhoods and of responding to the force and power that was exerting on them. But what happened? What happened is that art collectors started to bring canvases into galleries and said, you know, why don't you spray paint on this? And then commodified this art and sold it to Wall Street investors who now have those pieces stored in hidden places away somewhere in New York and New Jersey for its value. What's its value? For them, it's monetary value. Not for the value of what it says and what it expresses and how it brings community. So it's just sucked up, it's taken, it's made into something that is a commodity bought and sold and stored away. We live in a time when everything is commodified. Mohammed Fadl, my friend, my colleague, who I studied with at the University of Chicago, who is professor of law at the University of Toronto School of Law. Many of you would have read Mohammed Fadl's articles on liberalism and civil society, democracy, etc. But Mohammed Fadl is also, his legal expertise is in finance, actually, in economics. And he wrote something very recently, just briefly, on his social media after the news of the scandal involving a popular internet teacher in America. And that person suing another Muslim teacher and preacher for for violating an agreement to use the products, knowledge products, that were created within this institution, right? Now, it's quite astounding. When you look at early books of Islamic law, there are vigorous debates about whether someone who teaches the Quran can take a payment. Because the fear that religion becomes commodified, the fear that religious knowledge, right, is used for worldly enrichment. So they're very careful about that. You know, how can we make sure that the people who teach and preach are supported, can make a living, and their families can be supported without religion becoming another commodity? And it's one of the reasons why last night, for those of you who are here, we talked about the Al-Qaf, about the religious endowments, and the importance of having an endowment that gives payment to those individuals, but it's not their product, right? They're serving in that institution. Now, Muhammad Fadl makes another statement. He says that he believes that the proliferation of these for-profit institutes, I mean, many people don't realize that many of these Islamic institutes, learning centers online, are not not-for-profit. They are for-profit. That these for-profit institutes, the reason that they have emerged, one of the reasons is because many of our Islamic centers and mosques simply are not paying teachers and imams well. Not only are they not paying them but they're not providing benefits, health care, retirement fund, etc. What people need in modern life to live. They can't make a living, and so many have developed this form of teaching that allows them to support their families. There's nothing necessarily wrong with that, except of the slippery slope of commodification, to the point where someone could say to someone else who's teaching about Islam, Quran commentary and other things, that they have violated terms of agreement, that there's proprietary knowledge of this religious learning business. So this is something, I don't know anyone who is studying this issue at any of our graduate schools or seminaries. The commodification of religion, religious expression, cultural, Islamic cultural expression. This is a key issue because it is so pernicious. I mean, we only need to remember, follow the money is everything. Think about Imam Abu Hanifa. What was his response when he was asked, why don't you write a book on wara? Wara means piety, humility, asceticism. He said, I wrote a book about finance and economy instead. Because so much of our morality and our ethics really has to do with how we use our money and where we get our money. And so this is a key issue that is, until now, really underdeveloped. And it's a problem for all of us. I mean, even chairs in Islamic studies at universities. I feel that I am so blessed because my chair in Islamic studies at Huron University College, the University of Western Ontario, is called the London and Windsor Community Chair in Islamic Studies. Why? Because the people from the City of London and the City of Windsor, Ontario, Muslims and their friends, their interfaith friends, collected funds to establish this chair. Most of my colleagues, their chairs are called the, billionaire so-and-so chair in Islamic studies, or the dictator of this country chair. I'm not saying that they shouldn't take that money. But, how do we, is there a potential for having a problem about evaluating the economic and political structures within which we're teaching, if this is where our money comes from, where our chairs come from. So it's really a big dilemma. So I would love to see that if we are going to, you know, be, if we want to be people who are really contributing to the welfare of this society and to the world, we need to care about these things. You know, one of my little aphorisms or sayings that I put in the ethical toolbox when I teach Islamic ethics and we're gathering it is that charity is no substitute for justice. Charity is no substitute for justice. So when we think about young people who are going out and we're encouraging them to do good work, social justice work, soup kitchens, you know, food banks, free health care clinics, all of these kinds of things, we have to remember that charity is no substitute for justice. Charity is to fill in the gaps, right? And that's true about zakat as well. You may have heard people say, well, if everyone paid their zakat, there would be no, you know, injustice, no poverty in the world. That's not true. It's simply not true. Because zakat is to fill in the gaps. There are also, and there always have been, in Islamic law, rules and laws to limit the unjust acquisition of wealth, to pay the worker. Idfil ajir qabla an yajif arakahu. Pay the worker before the sweat of his brow dries, right? Labor laws, pay the worker before the sweat of his brow dries. So you've got a place where, you know, dispensing charity all over the world, but the workers aren't even being paid on time or a fair wage. I mean, at the time when there was slavery, the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, told Abu Dhabi, feed him what you eat, clothe him what you wear, and don't give him too much work. And if you give him too much work, help him with the work. Okay, same food, same clothes, right? A living wage. And there's no honor or dishonor in any kind of work. If you're required to help with the work, it means you're not above. You know, there's no class, there's no manual. Throughout Islamic history, we had the emergence of terms like the masses and the elite. Wow, where is that in the Quran? But it is consistent in our books of law and politics. We need to deconstruct that. If we're really going to be contributing to the welfare of society, it means that we have to have a critical eye on our tradition as well. Not all bad, not all good. You know, where injustice is, we correct it. If the beloved companions of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and they struggled so much. They were our best examples for their struggle, but they weren't perfect. And when they weren't, they corrected each other. When they did something wrong, when they fell into racism or injustice or misogyny, how often did Aisha, may God's peace and blessing be upon her, correct men when they said things that were misogynistic? She corrected them. You know, we need to have that same critique. So we take from our tradition. We take from our tradition and we learn so much from it, but we don't fetishize it. It's not what we worship. It's what we draw our strength from, but we don't worship it. So if I return from this issue of commodification, which is so important, and young people see our hypocrisy. They see our hypocrisy. So if we don't solve these issues, it's going to be critical. But we take that back to what I began with the community and the expression of the community's values, joys, and pain. And we think about culture and the creation of culture and rites of passage and spirituality. Again, the unfortunate commercialization of everything that's good that happens in today's world. I mean, when, if we talk about the commercialization of Christmas, shall we talk about the commercialization of aid? You know, we're so desperate to have our children like aid, enjoy it, and not feel that it's a boring holiday compared to Christmas, that we think the solution is to shower them with stuff. Doesn't work. Because stuff is not meaning. What human beings want is meaning and purpose in their life, not stuff. Stuff makes you happy for a minute, the sugar high, the sugar rush, you know, you eat the chocolate bar, it's delicious. Then you're crashed, passed out on the couch, you know, an hour later from this spike in your blood sugar. These things are that too. So what do we need? We need really meaningful community expressions of our values, joy, pain. We need culture that is embedded in place, season, memory, and life cycles. If we think about, you know, just take one rite of passage in traditional Islamic society. It used to be that a boy's circumcision was the occasion for a tremendous rite of passage. It was used to be done at an older age, not as a child, not as a baby. So if we think about in the Ottoman Empire, one of the things that the elite often did was to sponsor these gigantic public circumcision celebrations. So if like their son at 7 years old was having his circumcision, they would sponsor it for all of the boys that age. They would get clothes. There would be a few days of picnics and families coming together. Really beautiful. I mean, not just stuff, but community, right? The idea that you're no longer a child, you're going to the next rite of passage. Now, I think it's probably very good that we don't circumcise boys at that age anymore, that it happens at a younger age, with, you know, anesthetic and whatever else happens. But where is the rite of passage for a boy to become now a young adult, and a girl to become a young woman, and on? They feel it. I mean, our kids, they see, you know, how many Muslim children have come home and said, "I want a bar mitzvah," after going to their friend's bar mitzvah. Wow, it wasn't only about the party and the stuff, but it's now I'm being recognized as someone with some responsibility. So for our children to feel that they're part of us, that they're necessary to us, that they're necessary to our future, that their lives have meaning, we need to be able to come together and really think about how in this land, in America, we can develop those celebrations, those rites of passage, those cultural markers in a way that has meaning. We need more happiness, more joy to be resilient. You know, there's too much sadness, too much self-control, too much seriousness. I look at our young people very often, I see that. Where is the opportunity for their expressing themselves? And when I talk to people, I hear things like, oh yes, you know, well, one time the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, was with his companions and they were having fun with each other. After they ate watermelon, they were throwing like watermelon rinds at each other. Okay. Yes, next. What's next? I mean, there's a kind of like stop. Well, it's okay, you can have some fun. Yeah, but tell me how it's done in community together. I mean, you know, that telling me that they threw watermelon rinds at each other to have fun is not the answer. We're talking about research and institution and developments and practices that need to happen. I think about how when I went to New Zealand a few years ago, there's a wonderful woman named Alia who's American. She's actually originally from Michigan. She's lived in New Zealand for a long time. And one of the things she found is that New Zealand had accepted a lot of refugees from Somalia. And she was working volunteering with the community. Now, if you think about the kind of typical New Zealander, and you think about the typical Somalian, just the physical differences. When I went there, you know, all these girls were small, a couple inches smaller than me, you know, in a land of kind of tall people. And there's that discomfort. Where am I? Beautiful people, of course, but what am I supposed to do here? And as young people, what do young people do? They go to clubs, they go to bars, they have parties, and boyfriend, girlfriend, all of these things. They couldn't do that. So what could they do? There were not things that they could find to do. And so with this sense of insularity, of sadness, of being afraid, sort of walking around worried, you know, on the street, is someone gonna say something Islamophobic or look at them in a strange way? So Aaliyah said, I need to ground these children in this land. She did something beautiful. She developed a 3-year leadership program for girls, young women, between ages 14 and 17. A 3-year commitment that's all about leadership focused on outdoor leadership. They learned how to kayak. They learned how to camp. They learned how to start a fire. They learned how to climb a mountain. They learned the names of all of the animals and the plants. They were rappelling down mountainsides. And all the time, of course, as they're together, they pray when it's the time for prayer. They fast when it's the time for fast, to fast, etc. If you looked just at the posture of these young women who went through this program, compared to the others, it's amazing. Standing straight, heads up, strong, like there's a physical strength. If you saw one of those young women walking down the street, didn't matter if she was 4'11", you were like, wow, that's, you know, there was strength radiating from that person. Strength that came from physical strength, but also from confidence of being grounded in the land. We are not just souls, we're embodied souls. We're people in bodies. And the importance of place is critical. When you think about the creation story in the Quran, what is it that makes Sayyidina Adam able to be the Khalifa of God on earth, the steward of the earth by the command of God? It is by knowing the names of things, being taught the names. So to be in this environment, and we live in an age of great displacement, migration, you know, so many refugees, so many immigrants, but also all of us are migrating constantly, going away to go to school, to work somewhere else, moving. How do we become grounded in that place? To know the names of the trees, the birds, the mountains, the rivers, you know where you are, right? Otherwise, people are just, you know, where am I? And of course, that leads to an identity crisis. But to be grounded in the land is important, and I would like to see more study in embodiment and the importance of place and location. And being connected as one of God's creations with other, the rest of creation. We're not a part of it, we are part of it. And I think that leads me into the next thing, which is, it's something that we've had in the past, but has been really lost in modern America. And it's one of the reasons why, when we think about what Islam is as a tradition, it's very helpful to us think about different ways of categorizing Islam and what we do. So I remember when we first founded the Nahwi Foundation, having conversations with Dr. Muhammad Abdullah. We used to speak about, I remember saying to him that I don't really love the idea of the Abrahamic traditions. I understand the benefit of it as a way of kind of bringing the idea of community of faiths, but I don't particularly love it because it one reasserts a patriarchal framework, where Islam is about our relationship to God, but to call it the Abrahamic traditions is a real reassertion of a patriarchal framework that that excludes women's role, at least conceptually, as a frame. If we think about Hajj, I mean, it's the partnership. Mecca was founded by our mother, Hajj. Right? It was her submission to God, her choice to submit to God, her choice to stay there, and the miracle that came to her, the angel came to her and to her child and spoke to her. So, and we imitate her in our pilgrimage. But I understand there's a benefit to some extent, but sometimes we have to, you know, after we had a lot of conversations about this and we went on our trip to China, Dr. Ullman wrote this paper, Beyond the Abrahamic Box, and looked at how Islam in China has had this relationship with the Confucius tradition and expressed itself in terms that were comprehensible to the people who were grounded in the Confucius tradition. So that shows us another way. And the reason why we went on these Nowe Foundation trips was really to try to get ideas, to stimulate ideas for how, you know, what are all the different options for being Muslims in America? How do we create this culture? And so we saw that outreach with Confucianism. We saw the women's mosques, an ancient tradition in China, and the women imams of China. It was really mind-blowing to look at that tradition. It gave us ideas for back here. But I'm an Americanized Canadian. So I'm Canadian, I lived in America for over 20 years, went back to Canada. And I'll tell you one thing in Canada, the most important social issue in Canada, the most important political issue, and the people who are really leading Canada forward in terms of social justice are the First Nations people of Canada, the Indigenous or Aboriginal people of Canada, are much more present and visible than in America. Much more present and visible. And I'll tell you, I think this is an area where American Muslims really need to start doing their history. Go to Washington, D.C., go to the Museum of the American Indian, see all of the broken treaties, and think about what kind of ethical obligation that lays upon us, who are people of the Quran that emphasizes again and again and again, fulfill your covenants. Fulfill your covenants. We are the beneficiaries. We are now, you know, we can't say, well, I just came here. Yeah, I came here, but I'm getting the benefits of this country, so I also now must bear the historical burdens of what's been done in the name of citizenship and this nation. Those covenants and treaties need to be fulfilled. But the beautiful thing about what we find, the Muslim community, about having closer relationships with the Indigenous people of Canada is to really illuminate again for us the importance, forgotten importance often, of land, place, water in our tradition. And the fact that we believe that there is life in all things. It's very interesting. You know, at Hartford Seminary, I was one of the editors of the Muslim World Journal, the first English language journal devoted to the study of Islam and Christian-Muslim relations in the United States. And it was founded by missionaries who were really keen on evangelizing to the Muslim world, and so we know about the notorious Samuel Zwemer and his attacks on Muslims. But what's very interesting is if you look at I looked up some of the early articles, is how he makes an analogy between Muslim beliefs and the beliefs of indigenous people in the Americas, calling them animus. Animus. Why? Because of the belief that all living things have spirit or a relationship with God. What do we say as Muslims? All living things are Muslim. too. They have their fitra, their nature that is implanted in God, and have their communities and have their ways of worshiping God. And so this was lifted up by Zwemer as an animist belief, like the indigenous people. And what happened in modernity is that so many Muslims were so eager to fit into the Enlightenment view of modernity, they were embarrassed by things that were labeled superstition by the Enlightenment reform tradition in particular, that a lot of things that really uplifted our place as creations of God among other creatures of God was left to the wayside. And it's time to lift those up again. Because if we want to talk about young people in America and about civic engagement, perhaps there's no issue more important than saving our environment.
Amen.
Saving our earth. God's earth. This is God's earth. The whole earth has been made a masjid for you. But what if it's polluted? How are we to make wudu if our water is filled with toxic things? I mean, the basic, you know, connecting our rituals with the environmental movement really means paying attention. What is the first thing that's taught in a book of fiqh is how to identify whether water is pure or not. We live in a modern era, we're just like, oh, turn on the tap and make wudu. No, we got to think about it. We really got to think about it, about what it means, what obligation there is for us to work on this so that now we won't have a bifurcation between Islamic issues and environmental issues or social justice issues. These are all one, and these are our issues. And this is what we need in our civic engagement, in our social justice, in the way we raise our children, is integration. Meaningful integration, and it is there, it's present, it's right in front of us. I mean, I can't know where to pray unless I know where I am in the world. Ground yourself in the place. Where is the sun? Where am I in the world? What about this water? If you were going to be making wudu, making ablution in Flint, Michigan 2 years ago, is that water even valid for your ablution? It's full of toxic things. So it's not just a social justice issue for others, it is at the core of Muslims even being able to fulfill our most basic obligation. So we need, you know, having relationships with the indigenous people of this land is necessary in order for us not to be in an ethical violation of broken treaties and covenants. Second, it is a way for us to reintegrate back into our spiritual practice and our worldview the reality of the fact that we have a not just a brotherhood of humanity, but a brotherhood of created things. And to bring that back. And my final section, I'd like to talk about the necessity of cognitive science and understanding the human mind and how the human mind works. It is impossible to be an ethical, faithful person without understanding how the human mind works. And I don't see a lot of, I suppose that in some of our seminaries that some of this is assumed, maybe that in the undergraduate education people might take, you know, a basic psychology course, but I don't think we should really make those kind of assumptions. But if we look at some of the reasons why, you know, the source of some of the most significant injustices in our society, we see things like implicit bias, in-group preference, framing, cognitive framing. What does this mean? It means that when we walk through the world, we never see people for who they are. We see them through our cognitive frames that have been created through experience, through language, through socialization, through media representation, etc. And what that means, and certainly as Muslims we know that, right? We know that because when we, you know, encounter someone, we know that they can't say, oh, I don't know anything about Muslim. Because we are swimming in an atmosphere filled with stereotypes and biases about Muslims. And so that's why we get those strange questions. Sister, last night you mentioned some of those questions that you get as a Muslim, you know, that you have to have some patience with. You know, why do you have to wear that? Or you don't have to wear that. Or what do you think about that terrorist attack? What do you think I think about the terrorist attack? Right? So it shows we have experienced that we're not, when we encounter people, it's not just a blank slate. We've been shaped by things that are much older than that. You know, if you look at, I studied as an undergraduate, one of my areas of expertise was art history. Well, look at the Muslim in our history, in Western art, or song, or literature. How about Dante, for a start? I mean, there is a long tradition, right, that is shaping impressions that most people, good people, are just, they don't even know that they have. We all have that too. Racism is a pervasive reality of our world. It is a pervasive reality of America. It is a problem. It does not, you can't just say, well, I'm not a racist. You cannot be a racist thinking you're not a racist and still have a lot of bias that you aren't even aware of. And this is one of the things that the Quran tells us, is that we have to know ourselves. You know, we can't just be walking through the world, you know, all groggy and thinking it's okay. No, we have to analyze, we have to know ourselves, we have to study ourselves. And we have to become aware of our biases. We all have them. We all have those biases. How do they work? How are they formed? How do we deconstruct them? How do we overcome them to the extent that we can? And if we can't overcome them, then like a person who needs some kind of disability accommodation, restructure our institutions to make up for that fact. I mean, to some extent, we're all disabled by our cognitive biases. And the only way to get rid of it is not to deny it and say and make it just a moral issue. It is an issue of formation that we'll, you know, try to form in a different way, but it can't happen without restructuring institutions, because it emerges again and again and again. Same thing with patriarchy. And it's really interesting to me, when I founded the chaplaincy program at Hartford Seminary, when I was first asked to come to Hartford Seminary to establish a leadership program for Muslims, and they said, you know, something like an imam program. I said, okay. And I thought about it and studied it for about 2 years and talked to people about what would be needed to really achieve the goal that I wanted of having a more responsible, well-trained leadership who was present where Muslims were in society. And one of the things I said is I'm not gonna run any program that excludes women. It has to be, whatever program we have has to be equally open to male and female leadership. What's been interesting to me over the years, as I've seen the chaplains graduate and emerge and take positions, is how difficult, without finding new language, it is for women chaplains who are equally trained often have more training, have more skills to earn the same esteem as a religious leadership leader as the male chaplains. And how the term chaplain itself keeps getting dropped for men and they're called imam. So many of our male chaplains are called imam so-and-so. You know, even after 6 months of training, suddenly they're an imam. And some woman who's been, you know, serving in prison chaplaincy for 30 years is sister so-and-so. It's very interesting because these titles, if you look at classical Islamic literature, women had titles sheikha, imama, faqiha, right, alima. But in contemporary America, the context of American religious leadership has exerted itself in a certain way, and the idea of the imam as the prayer leader in the mosque is so strong that it's become impossible to talk about women imams. You know, imam, it simply means leader. It doesn't mean that you have to give the Friday khutbah or lead a mixed gender congregation. It means leader. Imam Abu Hanifa, he wasn't the prayer leader in a mosque, he was an imam in fiqh, right? In law. So we need to, this is another thing that we need to take note of. Our young people have no patience with patriarchy, you know, anymore. And we see that. We see that for the, you know, look at Hind Mekki's side entrance blog, look at the emergence of women's mosques, look at the unmosque movement. This is an issue that is of urgent importance for our community. It is my belief that every mosque should have a male and a female spiritual leader. I have no problem if they have different responsibilities. Let the imam give the khutbah and lead the mixed congregational prayer. Let the female imam give religious lessons and teachings and spiritual guidance and support to both men and women. Whatever it is, or let the male imam only counsel men and the female imam can just counsel women. Then we get rid of some of these problems we have of blurred lines, ethical, professional, ethical violations that we've seen, secret marriages, etc. It's not, you know, these issues are not going to be solved just by saying the right thing. This is a structural problem. If you have women leaders who are working on an equal footing with male imams, I bet you're going to have a lot less secret marriages. If you don't know what I mean, you can go and read Sheikha Zainab Ansari's articles that you can find them. Zainab Ansari was a scholar in residence at Taysir Institute in Knoxville, Tennessee. May God preserve her and bless her. Brilliant scholar, brilliant teacher, who wrote a few articles about this issue. So how do we do it? Again, it's something that we need some creativity, we need some trial and error, but we also need a commitment from the community to have paid positions for women religious leaders, whatever form that is. Otherwise, things are really going to continue to fall apart. Finally, and this is the last thing I'll say, and then we have some time for discussion. You've been very patient. I know this has been a long presentation. I began this talk, you know, mentioning how I feel there's a lot of stress in our community. I don't think that's going to go away. You know, from this current administration to white supremacy to Islamophobia to, you know, the floods of refugees to, you know, we just look at that. I mean, it would be enough to simply look at the line of people fleeing Myanmar into Bangladesh to have your heart broken. Just tragedy after tragedy. I believe that it's because we do not pay enough attention to how we're feeling, that we don't have enough support in our communities for discussing those feelings, those tension, those stress, those sadness, not just individual counseling, but really being together and mourning together, and talking about how it affects us, that we have this tension that builds. And if any of you, how many of you have studied The Theory of the Scapegoat by René Girard? I think it's really important for us to think about. Because, you know, I'm not an expert in this theory, but from what I understand, what happens is that, you know, the theory is that in any community, tensions emerge over time and they build up. And the scapegoat is a way to kind of pour all of that tension onto something that then provides relief. It is a kind of purification of the community. It's we've gotten rid of all of this fracture, anger, conflict, stress, and it's all placed on the scapegoat. And now we could be back together and feel a sense of harmony and community and sincerity. I think because we don't have good mechanisms of dealing with our internal tensions, that what we're seeing recently is a persistent emergence of a scapegoating mechanism. Think about over the past 3 years in American Islam, how one individual or another who may have made a mistake, said something wrong, or had an ijtihad, decided that there was a different tactic or way to approach a subject. Think about should Muslims go to the White House for Eid? Right? How many of you remember that controversy? Right? And what we see is that what may be a difference of a legitimate difference of opinion about political tactics and perspective suddenly explodes into this, you know, verbal violence and attack on people, on their sincerity. And this issue becomes a litmus test for right or wrong. Brother Suleiman read something from my book at the beginning about the Khawarij. This was the methodology of the Khawarij in the first century. They made one issue the litmus test for whether you're sincere or not. Right? For those of you who know the history of the Khawarij. And if people didn't agree with them about that issue, they said, you have no sincerity, you're not truly a believer. And of course they went on and committed great acts of violence against those people. We don't have people killing each other, but they're killing their spirits on social media. I mean, where you have an issue like, you know, the White House of Thought, and it becomes just an opportunity for the release of all of this tension and anger. You know, we can't do much about the state of the world. We can't do much about this administration. We protest and do things, but we can't really change it. But here we can all be reunited as we are righteous and that person is unrighteous. And just dump on that person and grind them down and just feel this, finally I have some kind of, you know, purity. And we all agree on that. You know, this social justice warrior phenomenon. So we need some more work on social psychology, on these dynamics, on how to relieve built up tension, on why these things get out of control. We need study on these issues. And we need to become self-aware. Because those kind of conflicts are demoralizing people. It's just too much conflict. Computer's like, I'm just walking away from it. Like, I don't need more of this in my life. Life's hard enough, I don't need more of this in my life. So, again, I'm not an expert in it. Hoping some of you are or will become experts in this. So these are just a few of my humble suggestions for some of the issues we need to deal with in Islam in America. And thank you for your attention. I'll stop it here, and then we can have the opportunity for a little discussion. Thank you, Sami.